Decades ago, brave individuals sustained by the strength of their convictions, fueled by their desire for change, and represented by lawyers from this eminent organization, including visionary attorneys like Thurgood Marshall, Robert Carter, and Jack Greenberg, embarked on a dangerous, long, and grueling march that culminated on May 17, 1954, at the United States Supreme Court. It was a march that led through difficult and uncertain terrain, from the injustice of Plessy versus Ferguson, to the dark days of Jim Crow, and of slavery by another name, from the discrimination and violence and the strange fruit that slavery by another name, from the discrimination and violence and the strange fruit that ultimately gave rise to a unified civil rights movement and to the founding and growth of LDF. It was a march that tested the soul of this country and questioned, as President Abraham Lincoln once asked, whether a nation dedicated to the proposition that all are created equal could long endure. And it was a march that was immeasurably strengthened by the transformative power of a single court decision, where nine jurists came together, led by one of my idols, Chief Justice Earl Warren, with the eyes of the world upon them, to unanimously declare that separate was inherently unequal. Now, I was just 3 years old in 1954 when Brown was decided. Please don't do the math. Yeah. He's that old? Thanks to some of the pioneers in this room, my generation, was the first to grow up in a world in which separate but equal was no longer the law of the land. Even as a child growing up in New York City, I understood, as I learned about the decision, that its impact was truly groundbreaking, bringing the law in line with the fundamental truth of the equality of our humanity. Yet although Brown marked a major victory, like anyone old enough to remember the turbulence of the 1960s, I also knew and saw firsthand that this country wouldn't automatically translate the words of Brown into substantive change. The integration of our schools, a process that was halting, confrontational, and at times even bloody, did not by itself put an end to the beliefs and the attitudes that had given rise to the underlying inequity in the first place. The outlawing of institutional segregation did not by itself soften the enmity and alleviate the vicious bias that had been directed against African American people and communities for generations, and the rejection in its clearest form by our highest court of legal discrimination could not by itself wash away the hostility that would for years fuel new and perversely innovative attempts to keep separate but equal in place. These markers of progress could not forestall the massive resistance policies that followed in states across the country, in which public schools were closed and private academies were opened for white children only. They could not avert the protest that greeted the Little Rock Nine, brave young students who required the protection of the 101st Airborne Division of the United States Army to enroll in an all-white high school. And they could not prevent Alabama Governor George Wallace from making his infamous stand in the schoolhouse door in 1963, 9 years after Brown, when two courageous African-American students, one of whom, as you've heard, Vivian Malone, which would much later become my sister-in-law, when they attempted to register for classes at the University of Alabama. But thanks to Brown and to the developments that followed, on the day when Vivian and her classmate James Hood walked into that university, they were protected not only by the power of their convictions, not only by the strength of the National Guard and the authority of the United States Department of Justice, but by the force of binding law. When those nine students entered Little Rock Central High School, they were supported by all nine members of a resolute Supreme Court. And when millions of civil rights advocates and supporters began to rally, to march, to stand up, and even to sit in order to eradicate the discrimination that they continued to face in schools and other public accommodations, they stood not only on the side of equality and on the side of that which was obviously right, but on the side of settled justice. Now, this was the sea change that Brown versus the Board of Education signaled. And this was the progress it made possible. It did not instantaneously or painlessly tear down the walls that divided so much of the nation, but it did unlock the gates. And it continues to guide LDF's work and the Justice Department's civil rights enforcement efforts as we work to end the divisions and the disparities that persist even today in the 21st century. After all, as Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor said recently, in what I think is a very insightful dissent in the Michigan College admissions case, we must not, let me quote, we must not wish away rather than confront the racial inequality that exists in our society. The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to speak openly and candidly on the subject of race, unquote. And I would add, to act to eradicate the existence of still too persistent inequalities. And I want to assure you, as we mark this historic anniversary, that my colleagues and I remain as committed to this cause as ever before. While the number of school districts that remain under desegregation court orders has decreased significantly in just the past decade, the Department of Justice continues to actively enforce and monitor nearly 200 desegregation cases where school districts have not yet fulfilled their legal obligation to eliminate segregation root and branch. In those cases, we work to ensure that all students have the building blocks of educational success, from access to advanced placement classes to facilities without crumbling walls and old technology to safe and positive learning environments. We are partnering with the Department of Education to reform school discipline policies that fuel the school-to-prison pipeline and that have resulted in students of color facing suspensions and expulsions at a rate that is 3 times higher than that of their white peers. And we are moving in a variety of ways to dismantle racial barriers and to promote inclusion from America's classrooms to our boardrooms to our voting booths and far beyond. So long as I have the privilege of serving as the Attorney General of the United States, this Justice Department will never, never stop working to expand the promise of a nation where everyone has the same opportunity to grow, to contribute, and ultimately to succeed. By calling for
That's the avant-garde DJ, remixer, and I call him a soundologist, Dr. L, featuring David Walters, from with roots in St. Kitts and Martinique with Hold On. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Monday, May the 19th, and we were listening to U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder addressing or commemorating the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, this landmark case decided in 1954 and 1955 when the U.S. Supreme Court actually put together a plan for desegregation. And that was at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. this past Friday. You know, I listened to that speech in its entirety, and I can't tell you how depressing it was, although, of course, he meant it to be a kind of hopeful message that the struggle continues and that we are, as a nation, we are doing our lot. We're carrying our fair load of the struggle in continuum. And I would say no, that's not the case at all. Brown versus Board of Ed is actually a consolidation of five major cases that the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, now called simply the NAACP the Legal Defense Fund, they've been fighting these cases at state courts for approximately 20 years. And simply to get basics, remember I talked about in any society you measure the quality of life in a society based on how the strategic resources are allocated to all citizens. Education is a major resource. And it is no accident that the NAACP, Thurgood Marshall and those before him who were handling the previous cases, that they chose education as the battleground to confront the system. Ironically, it was where African Americans had their highest hopes and dreams and aspirations, and education was extraordinarily important, very, very important in African American life. And it was also the weakest spot in the governmental system. Its inability, its absolute horrible performance with respect to delivering quality educational services to African Americans. Here's what really is telling. Now, this decision, of course, was 1954. And it was, in effect, as he correctly pointed out, that it galvanized the latter day, what we know as the latter day civil rights era, the civil rights era of the 60s. And I say latter day because we have to bear in mind that the first Civil Rights Act passed in the United States was in 1866. And it was just the first Civil Rights Act. Now, questions, just logical questions. If the U.S. became an official country, if you will, in 1776, when all men are created equal, as he quoted Lincoln, carefully editing out the word men, he says, all are created equal. Why does it have to require, if we live in such a democratic society, why would it require specific legislation addressing the matter of African Americans? Well, of course, we know why. The Dred Scott decision said that African Americans were not even people. And we had the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments having to do with what rights shall we as a dominant society accord the people we used to enslave and their progeny? Do we educate them so that they can be like us at our level? Absolutely not. I think it is time for us to get very real and very frank about history and stop this nonsense of presenting a romanticized version of this noble struggle for rights on the one hand, and the legal battle. This was not about legal battles and all of that in a court of law. The court of law wasn't a court of law. The Supreme Court wasn't acting in legal fashion. The courts weren't operating fairly at that time. The courts were instruments of repression and oppression. So when we hear the U.S. Attorney General, and I guess he has to do that because, well, that's his milieu. And he's being very nice because he can't be frank, publicly frank, and still hold on to his job. But he got, by inference, he let us know that he's aware that the legal system is very illegal in the things that it has done, and especially in this area of education. So important was education. Now, I told you about the civil rights, the first Civil Rights Act being passed in 1866. And then we hear that long before 1866, in Boston, Massachusetts, we had the first petition, a formal petition to a government to do the right thing, and that was in Massachusetts. And that was proffered by a man who himself had been enslaved. His name was Prince Hall. He was enslaved by the Halls, hence his last name. So important was education to Prince Hall and to the people. They understood that our very existence, our continuation, our future has to be safeguarded. And the best way to do that is to fight like hell for some kind of education for our children. We do not want our children to go through what we have gone through. In 1787, Prince Hall submitted a formal petition asking for education for what were then called the colored children of Massachusetts. Of course, he was turned down. There was no intention to deliver education to children, colored children. And so, like many, many stories you would hear coming out of the South and all around the country, it did not deter him one bit. He started school in his home and then moved it to a church. And that typically is where most of the black schools started. They started independently and they started with people taking on the task themselves to educate their own children. There were no illusions then about whether there was a desire to educate all citizens of America. There was no pretenses there at all. And so people understood that their job, their duty, included seeing to the future by safeguarding the education of children. Whether they were their parents or not, it didn't matter. I have a friend whose family comes out of Oklahoma. And last summer, they usually have every couple of years a huge family reunion. And I helped her prepare the family history book. And it was fascinating to see this ramshackle little building, a little kind of a shack, actually. And there was the teacher very nicely and neatly dressed, and all these children in front of their little shack of a school with ribbons in their hair, and the little boys with their pants and their shoelaces untied, some of them, but they were all in order and lined up and looking like somebody cared about them. And I came to learn that that school was built by the family members who were in fact slaves on that plantation. And the first thing they did out of their meager resources was to set aside some money to buy enough land to build that little shack of a school. And that is the history of education. The United States, there was no intention ever of creating an equal society. We shouldn't lie to ourselves about that. There was no intention of promoting equality and freedom and democracy and all these ideals that people throw around. Not at all. This was a virulently apartheid state. It was an apartheid country. In fact, one could say in the sense that we taught the fine art of race oppression to many parts of the world who looked to the scientific application of this method of oppression in the United States. We get mixed up, you see, when we hear, we hear Eric Holder speak very passionately and so forth about all the things that the Justice Department will do to guarantee anything. And there's wisdom in examining our forebears and their approach. They weren't waiting. They were not waiting for the government. In fact, they were highly suspicious of the government. So they took that matter under their own charge. Because they were best equipped to educate their children. But talking, you heard him say, in 200, he himself had to emphasize it twice, 200 school districts to this day, 60 years after the Brown decision, 200 school districts in the United States still haven't come into compliance. When will they? When will they come into compliance? And how long must people wait for that to happen? I ask all the time, what is the cumulative damage done to the educational futures of African American and Latino children in this country? Because all of these years, from 1787, from Prince Hall to now, from Plessy to now, from Dred Scott to now, how many years must people wait for the government, the supposedly very capable government, to deliver a basic resource that in any country, even the most backward of countries, understands the need to deliver quality education to all of their citizens? Are we not seeing the world reaction to that now in Nigeria and other parts of the world? In this leading country of the world, the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney General, is telling us we still have 200 plus districts, maybe even more, who still are yet to come into compliance. it bothers me that there is this reticence about it. There's this sense of, well, lack of reticence, I should say. This feeling that, we'll just have to wait and see. You've waited long enough. What more do you want? What more does America need to get the message that there will be no equal education in this country? It is not going to happen. I could read you any number of initiatives and laws that were passed in the 1700s and the 1800s and the 1900s and the 21st century. All kinds of laws are on the books. And somehow, the same people who from the very beginning were denied education are the same people being denied it today. How many programs have we done about the fact that school districts are deliberately just absolutely tearing up educational futures of poor children? We did it just last week, Thursday, where we learned, of course, that New Orleans, there are no public schools in New Orleans at all. They're all charter schools. It's just children are now just pure revenue, just purely revenue. Now comes this new system, rocket ship, with its idea of snatching up 1 million, at least 1 million Black and Latino children in their grasp. And they don't have to have a full curriculum. And they don't really have to have competent teachers. And we'll just, have them play video games for most of the day, just to calm them down and see if they could behave. Other than that, we don't care if they learn. What has to happen? Do they really have to come to our houses and open the doors and drag the children out of the houses and just put them in some kind of a mass warehouse and shoot them and just say, well, your futures are forfeited anyway? The fact that this country remains governable, given what is happening, he talked himself, and he is the U.S. Attorney General, talking about the school-to-prison pipeline. When have we tolerated this language? When is that tolerable? That we can hear these things. These programs are actually in progress, and we're just dead to the enormity of the slaughter that is going on. The fact is that we have been encouraged to become romantic about this whole notion of struggle. Struggle is not something that we see an end to. We are the people of interminable struggle. It is what is intended. So in as much as it's happening, it probably is following course. It is going according to plan. We're talking, folks, about a system of oppression. This is one of the things I want to distinguish, and I've been talking about this. It's not just racism. To call it racism is to diminish the enormity of this thing. This is a scientific method of oppression. It is oppression. It is a method. It is a plan to create permanently one group that will be dominant always, and everybody else having to figure out how to swim in whatever is left. That dominant group at one time had nothing. They had nothing, they got some. They got some, they want more. They got more, they want all. They got all and they want all for all time. That is white supremacy that I'm talking about. That is the construct of it. People saying horrible things and functionaries carrying out the plan, that's what they are. They're functionaries carrying out the plan, but there is a plan. And it should bother people that 60 years since the last great effort, all right, since 1866, in fact, even before that, the year before, with the passage of the 13th Amendment, but since forever, since African Americans landed here on these shores in chains, that it was determined that they never, ever, ever should progress. That is not part of the benefits that they should enjoy. Neither they nor their children's children, all the way down the line till the end of time. We are seeing a restructuring, a revved up version of what is about to come in the year 2043. I've been talking about that. And 14 states have already tilted past that racial demographic shift that will come in the year 2043, when, according to the Census Bureau, the U.S. will be a majority non-white nation. 14 states already are there. So it's actually going to happen sooner than anticipated. All these things bring to the fore a greater urgency to get these social and political constructs and economic pieces in place now. Get it done quickly. Because numerical disadvantage requires an even greater attention to political control and economic control and social control. The people we are hearing from, people like Eric Holder, would tell us that they're fighting, but they're fighting according to the system's plan. I haven't seen an alternative plan. The system still prevails. From the 1700s until now, it has prevailed. Every now and then, there's a little hiccup, but it gets around it. The agenda remains largely intact, and we have functionaries, which is what they are. The functionaries, their job is to execute the plan. I go back to Mr. Holder himself. I was the only reporter, the only one allowed in the room when the parents of Amadou Diallo came to Washington, D.C., insisting on a meeting with the Justice Department. I was with a group of African chiefs who insisted that if I didn't get into the room, they were not going to have a meeting with the Justice Department. They wanted me there. Other folks didn't want me there, but they did. Eric Holder was the deputy U.S. Attorney General at the time, and he headed up the Civil Rights Division. a person absolutely capable of doing what was asked, to launch an independent federal investigation into the shooting death of Amadou Diallo in February 1999. 41 shots were fired by four cops at this young man, whose only crime was he was just trying to get into his house after a long day at work. He was just trying to get to his home. 19 bullets struck him, but 41 shots were fired. Did Eric Holder deliver on that case? No. The system prevailed. All four cops walked. And we can count any number of cases that went that way since then. So when you have these functionaries, and I include, by the way, the president in that category, he's a functionary, but we have had people in high places who understand their job. Their job is to defend the system, to shore up the system, to make the system prevail. It is not generally to affirm the rights of the afflicted and the denied. We have a president, how often am I going to say this, who has come to power on a groundswell, unprecedented groundswell of support of people who, I would say, I know we would have exceptions, but for the most part, they make up that class of people who have been suffering all these years. And they want justice. They want equality. They want things to go the right way. They want a better life for their children. They want a job. They want schools that work. They want communities that are safe. All these things are interrelated. Our president's first priority is the system. And that is the way it will be until he leaves office. And the party, more than anything else, is absolutely dedicated to the system prevailing at the expense of those people who ought to be getting relief. So when these grand anniversaries come around and people speak, as they should, with some degree of reverence, because these were fighters. These men and women were fighters. We don't have those fighters anymore. We have people completely obsessed with their careers and what's good for them and how they will profit from a particular move. And for whatever it is that is in their personal interests, they will sell you out down the river all over again several times without even blinking an eye. What is going on in terms of education for our children is just, it is a crime against humanity. It is educational genocide. This is not an exaggeration, and I'm not trying to, an alarmist here. It is that bad. And it won't get better. Not under this president. It won't get better. And we have the thing that annoys me even more, which is that it is expected not only that you suffer these indignities for centuries and that you should have a sense of patience about it. Just wait. Just hurry up and wait. But then you also must take on the responsibility of rehabilitating a system that is snuffing out your life. We have to fix it. No. What people, I hope people understand that their job now, with more than enough evidence as to how the system plans to perform, the job is to absolutely destroy it. Make sure it doesn't hurt anybody again behind you. You destroy it. And you destroy it by destroying a party that rams this thing down our throats and says, this is the best we can do. And in this sense, the people who are suffering ought to understand that this is exactly the same temperament of the party back in the day. The impediments to progress, the terrorists, the internal terrorists that we had were the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party were the obstructionists. The Democrat Party was a party of the Klan. People should know that, in fact, a couple of civil rights acts were actually called Ku Klux Klan Acts. Ku Klux Klan Acts. The first Ku Klux Klan Act and the second Ku Klux Klan Act and the third Ku Klux Klan Act. These were all civil rights acts of 1870 and 1871. That's how powerful the Democrats were. And that mindset has not left the Democratic Party. They've dressed it up by saying, here are a couple of liberals, like Clinton and Gore and Sister Hillary. You should vote for them because these are not these kinds of people. And you examine their policies and you say, you are exactly these kinds of people. The community needs to wake up and take a stand in defense of its children. And if it doesn't happen, then you deserve what you get. And you should shut up and go away and stop annoying people with all of the complaints about what's not working right. You have the power to rectify the situation by absolutely punishing this Democratic Party. Make sure you do your best to make it, just bring it to its knees. I am telling you about struggle that had been taking place since the 1700s. And to this day, the Democratic Party functions exactly the same way, with one or two little tweaks in terms of difference in attitude. But it's the exact same result. Look at what your Democratic Party has done for you in Chicago and in New York City and in Washington, D.C. You have folks in Washington, D.C. who can't vote, as in for their own state. In Detroit, Philadelphia, you pick any major city. And you see what is going on now, the reorganization. In fact, back in the day, they were called, the Democrats called themselves the Redeemers. They were going to redeem the South. They were going to redeem Jim Crow. They were going to redeem the racist practices of the South, redeem and replace, bring back, revive slavery. And have they not done it? You show me any so-called urban school district that is actually performing well, where the children are up to par, where the school buildings are well equipped, and conducive to learning, where the teachers are well qualified, where they have their books and everything they need to actually engage in the education process. If you show me one urban district where that is happening, the entire future of African and Latino America, insofar as these are going to be the dominant subsets, if, as you will, these normal subsets are now going to be the majority population as of 2043. Evermore the reason to make sure that it is not possible for them and their children to operate competently, to operate competitively, to earn a decent living and to see their way, to be leaders. They may have more in number, but they won't have the brains. We're seeing that already. Look what we have in Congress. Look what we've got as leadership. So I bring this to your attention to say it's time to get serious about this nonsense of, you know, talking about these developments and anniversaries, and we look back with a sense of nostalgia, because we know, if we were to tell the truth, those times are done. These real leaders that we had in the 1950s, going back all the way to the 1920s and 30s and 40s, these people who took leadership seriously, going back even to the days of slavery, these people took care of business, and they had so much more to lose. And we have, in 60 years, we have yet to even accomplish one-tenth of what they did under extraordinary and extreme circumstances. We ought to be ashamed of ourselves. And all the more so that we accept these folks as leaders, that we accept this treatment from a party that has nothing but contempt. The number one job we have, as according to your president, is to go out there and make sure you vote and get everybody to vote Democrat. He doesn't care whether you have a job, because he knows he hasn't created one. He doesn't care whether your schools are closing, although 5,000 of them will be closed by the time he leaves office. He doesn't care whether all of these urban areas, as they're called, are being reclaimed in good old-fashioned Southern Dixiecrat style. Chase the people out. Bring their quality of life to a point of absolutely no return, that they just have to give up and walk away because there's no point in staying there anymore. And then you bring in the desirable people and you remake the city with the desirable people. And you keep this going, because 2043 is a big goal. We have to have a restructuring, a social restructuring, an economic restructuring, a political restructuring in place before 2043. That's the ultimate goal. And we're playing into the game, my friends, by allowing this genocide of our children, by not understanding what this is, a war, and it ought to be responded to in that sense of urgency, that we should tolerate no garbage for leadership, that we should have a zero tolerance level for these jokers who stand up and grab the lapels and instantly they are leaders. And the objective conditions of life in our community are going lower and lower and lower to the point of no return. So I don't want to hear about the romantic view of what Thurgood Marshall did. He stood up when it was time. And he held the fort. And a whole bunch of people like him did their job. They were present and accounted for. They were involved. They were in battle. They delivered way beyond expectation and certainly way beyond their material means. You're talking nonsense about we have 200 schools that still have yet to desegregate in 2014, and we think this is acceptable. And people are applauding this and saying, well, it's a lovely, well, he's a very nice man after all. As if this has anything to do with the collective good. So, what is our homework? Our homework is to really examine how far we have fallen. We've fallen down on the job. We have punked out big time. We have let our communities and our children and our futures, we have just basically left it to whatever, left it to chance. We ought to be in full fighting mode because a war is being waged against our children and against us. And if we're not worth fighting for, then we ought to just come clean and say it. We don't feel like fighting, and we're not worth fighting for. So we get this nonsense over with and stop bothering people about, you know, showing up at protests. Stop wasting people's time. We either commit or just shut up. It's way past time. Way past time. And stop this romantic notion, indulging in this romanticism that is being fed us all the time about what took place in the 60s. The 60s took care of itself. But between the 60s and today, simply people have just fallen down on the job. They have no interest. This looking for somebody else to solve the problem. It's not going to happen that way. I want to thank you for joining me today. I needed to get this off my chest because this is something that we will encounter time and again, and all the more so as we get, as I said, closer to election time this year. This is the time to strike. This is the very time to strike. Make this election as unpredictable as possible by simply refusing. Do not give the Democratic Party what it wants. Absolutely not. It has not done the job. Punish it severely without even blinking an eye. Let's meet again tomorrow, same time, same place right here at PRN.FM. And please pass word along. I do need to know that folks are talking to other folks and passing the word about this incredible radio station where we have a chance to talk frankly and openly with each other without fear of being misinterpreted. You know, people understand we're talking bravely here, and so everybody understands that it's all to be taken in context. So thank you so much for indulging me that way. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call, and I do like to hear from you. Certainly drop me a note at leadstories@gmail.com. or Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Let me know what you thought of this discussion. Well, it wasn't a discussion, my rant today. Thank you so much. I really believe it to be a pleasure and a privilege to be in your company. Thank you.